Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Kevin Boylow, Nazarita Goldhammer. We're co-hosts at Epis Radio. It is August 30th, the end of August. Unbelievable. We're pushing towards the end of summer. School is starting, has started for so many people. Can already feel in most places the coming of the cold. The winds have started to kick up. It's subtle, but it's there. And so we want to be cognizant of that. We want to be aware of that. Before long, we will be pushing in the fall and dealing with autumn and all that autumn brings, changes, the falling of leaves, and transformation. Transformational possibility coming in this season. So we are still involved in this conversation about a critical phenomenology of the earth and humans. We're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep going at it. This is the mark of good thinking. You keep going into it. You keep going at it. So phenomenology studies appearances, and we can't really do phenomenology without thinking of ontology. We, you know, the way that we create our foundations, foundational thinking, first philosophy determines how being appears. So this is a really handy principle. If we can figure out how being appears, then we can make some decisions about how being appears. Because look at it this way. If we've already determined how being appears by our thinking, how being presences itself by our thinking, then we're already constrained in how we think about things. In fact, our very thinking is likely to be constrained. So there was a school of thought that believed that we have a realm of freedom if we can get to this transcendental point and let beings appear as they are, that we can be within the real or reality. A lot of California meditation was based on that. Once upon a time, I studied all of California meditation. They're all based upon a few basic principles. And this was very, very much like the early notions of existentialism in Europe and even in the East. There has always been a notion that we have freedom or an autonomy that we can access through a methodology called meditation. But thinkers I'm involved with and thinkers that I know no longer believe that. That's considered to be a naive methodology. And critical phenomenology is a discourse that articulates that very principle. So it's this, that if you are part of a culture that has certain basic assumptions about the way things are, and you're brought up into that, and if you are a person who's lived your life in accordance with those assumptions, and you think of yourself as a thinking person, if you don't do the what I would call metacritical or a critical meta methodology, into your toolkit, then you're going to miss the way being is already presenting itself within which you make these thinkings and operational judgments. That doesn't strike me as a very critical or creative endeavor. And so that means we have to get down and dirty into the floor, in the basement of phenomenology. For example, the subject-object distinction, which is what phenomenology originally tried to transcend. A very important type of creative thinking might be able to overcome that. The whole idea of knowledge, the whole idea of science, they're built on basic assumptions. If we don't think about those assumptions or those first thinkings or first philosophies, then we've already been tainted. We've already consumed lots of Kool-Aid, and we'll never find our way out into a critical, creative type of thinking. Why are we so hung up on this idea? Well, Masarita and I are hung up on this idea because we're doing creative, critical ecosystem design, trying to think from the roots. Now, to be sure, it's very important to do the best we can in bad situations, right? In life, in work, in relationships. You know, you might reassemble and rearrange the elements that you have in your house to make the prettiest design that you can. You might go further. You might have a few extra bucks. You might go to garage sales and estate sales. You might search high and low for something new that you can put in your living space or workspace for design, or your external space in your yard for external design. You know, your private meditation space in your backyard patio or your backyard. You might even be, you might go further, and you might be an internet explorer, and you might try to get materials and objects and furniture and pieces from outside of your ecosystem, from somewhere else, somewhere far away. But we radicalize those notions, not only in thinking, but in creative problem solving, in nonviolent design work, in conflict resolution work. It's to push the radical creativity as far as you can go. And so critical phenomenology just is that. It says, let's draw from science fiction. Let's draw from the ancients. Let's draw from the most profound of Eastern thinkers and religious figures. Let's draw from them. Let's draw from the West, but let's go further. Because the thinking, believe it or not, the thinking historically in the last 10,000 years has got us to this point. Everybody's responsible. We're all responsible. And so critical phenomenology says, let's study the science of appearances. So it's a great science. Let's study it. How do things appear? They don't just appear. That's the thinking of the teenager. They just don't appear. We have, and this is not magic. Being presences itself in accordance with first philosophy, in accordance with the way we allow it to presence, just like people. They presence yourself, themselves in your life in the way that is allowed, or in marriages, or in friendships, or in cross-species friendships. Appearances come from ontologies, logos of being that are allowed by early decisions, value judgments, and decisions. This is critical phenomenology. I wanted to remind everybody of that. So I want to bring Nazarita into this video right away, because this, and we don't even have to use big words. We don't even have to use phenomenology. But we've got ourselves in the world in a pickle. Now, a pickle is a catch-22. And any Little League baseball player knows what a pickle is. A pickle is when you've hit the ball, you're running to the base, you've rounded first base, and you're making a decision. Do you run for second base? Did the ball you hit go far enough into the field where you have enough time to reach second base? Or should you stay safe on first? And a lot of little leaguers, depending upon the situation, make decisions, either stay on first or go to second, or stay on second and go to third. If you go for second base, but you didn't have quite enough time, then the outfielder throws the ball to the first baseman, and you haven't yet made it to second base. Now, first baseman is going to throw that ball really fast to the second baseman. All of a sudden, here you are running to base, and you're going to be out. So then you decide to go back to safety. Second baseman throws the ball to the first baseman, and the first and second baseman get closer and closer, and you're in a zugzwang position in which there's nowhere to go. This is what we've created on the earth and in the world with the way we allow beings to appear. Example, how we allow forests to appear. Forests are living, breathing beings. They regulate oxygen and carbon dioxide. We just think of them as lumber for a building. Or foxes and wolves, we see them as predators, evil predators, and yet they're vital parts of the ecosystem. So in other words, basic assumptions create the way beings appear in the human world. With that said, Nazarita, here we are continuing our discussion about critical phenomenology of the earth and humans. Glad that you're on the show. How do we approach this today? How do we talk about this allowance, letting beings be and appear in their own right? And what have we done wrong? Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. So I was really struck by a sentence this morning that I was sharing about Japanese studio architects, Kiyoki Takeda, and they designed and completed a plant-covered house. And the reason why they did this, they did something against convention, which is, you know, you usually do a roof with a little bit of dirt, which allows mosses to grow, and that's considered kind of a roof that is alive. But they went a step further, and they did something deeper on the roof and on all the surfaces, the top surfaces of the house, and actually surrounding the area of the house. Is they did something that was different. They made the roof more impactful so that living things could actually grow and put down roots instead of just mosses and grasses that had shallow roots, because they really looked at everything and they said, this living material needs a place to put down roots. And so we're going to design a house that is different than what is traditionally built, that is kind of transitory. Moss on roof can be transitory. It can dry out. It can catch fire. But deep-rooted trees and bushes and real growth on roofs needs a substantial structure in order to support the weight of the grass and the water that grow on top of roofs. And they did this. In this Japanese studio, it's called K-I-Y-O-A-K-I, T-A-K-E-D-A Architect. And their plant-covered house in Tokyo, is filled with soil for growing plants and trees. And the reason why they did that is because they designed this because they read an article. There's a scientific journal called Nature. And this is what struck me. They read that the mass of human-made objects has now exceeded that of all living biomass. And I just want to say that again because it so struck me because it relates directly to what we're talking about. It's like the living things being, and yet what they found was the mass of human-made objects now exceeded that of all living biomass. And this is an incredible sentence because we're talking about allowing beings to appear, and yet we're suffocating life on Earth with man-made things. We're building in an ecosystem where wolves and other wild animals have the only place to appear and live. We're building there and killing those that live there, the beings that appear there, so that we could produce man-made objects to fill that space instead of the living beings that are actually there. And this relates to everything. It relates to the grasslands of the Midwest, where we're now filling it with, like we talked about last week, Illinois produces, I think it was 89% of soybeans and corn that feeds cattle. And so what we're doing is we're substituting the animals that live there and the wild grasses that grew there that supported the whole ecosystem, we're supplanting that in order to raise food to eat food. Like we want to feed the food that we want to eat, which is, you know, murder, obviously. It's like you really took a cow in your mouth to chomp on it. This is what it would be. So I'm really intrigued by the idea of allowing beings to appear and what that really means. Instead of exterminating beings, not allowing them to appear or seeing their appearance and then wiping them out so that we could substitute something else in their place. And I think that concept is most important. What we want to substitute in place of living beings, of trees, of forests, of wolves, of leopards, of coyotes, of, you know, all kinds of birds and animals, non-humans that exist in our world, and other earth-oriented beings, we want to wipe them out. And even the book Half Earth, in which the premise is give half of the earth to other beings to leave it wild so that they could exist, seems absolutely out of print now because look at that concept. It's like we've taken up more than half the earth. To even give back half the earth, it is like to even give back a third would be huge because of what we've done. So this is really, really critical, what we're talking about, of allowing beings to appear, allowing trees and forests and the earth to actually be, and how do we actually do that? And I think you can't do it until you see it, until you actually experience it. And we were having a conversation about place and the way that we see place, in terms of the place as it exists in itself, for itself, and then the how we make memories in a place that are secondary to the place of existing, like water, it existing, and then what we do in the water is another layer of how we relate to that existence of that feature of water, like that living, breathing water that has its own being, and how our memories are made from that being. And so it isn't the totality of that essence of water, but it's our, what we take from that essence to personalize it. And so I think this makes me think so much of, you know, phenomenology and what really is. Like, are we really seeing what really is? Are we seeing what could be or what was? And that's a hard discussion, how to separate all of those and put them together. You made a comment and you said that they all have to work together, that we can't separate the now from the past or the future. They're integrated into one, which is very much like all beings being integrated into one. We can't say, well, that was past and this is the future, this is now. It is different. We're integrated. What happened in the past is a thread in our being. What happens in the future is the threads being made, and we can't cut them off because it doesn't make sense to do that. You can't rip the garment because it is a finished garment. So those are some beginning thoughts, appreciating so much of what you're talking about, of allowing the being to appear.
Thank you. So one of the, I'll tell you something kind of simple, and then we'll go dig a little deeper here. So there are lots of, there's been lots of discussions for years about colonialization, domination, you know, in cultural studies, social political philosophy, critical theory, environmentalists. And lots of people for many years have, and the smartest, have already noticed this a long time ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. They could see this coming where humans were trying to dominate everything. And you can also see that in private discourses about family therapy, marital therapy. We have done a lot of relational work, and you see where one spouse can completely dominate another in various ways, financially, with possessions or with ideas. And what happens is that there's no room or space for the other to present themselves. So this is a critical idea. There has to be a space. And a lot of relationships break, relationships of all kinds, employment, student-teacher, therapist and client, romantic partnerships, marriages, organizations, you know, all the way on up to great big international compacts and treaties. So we can imagine that there's a line, and above the line we see presencing, like in a Cartesian graph, and below the line we see a depresencing. We can imagine this. It's a simple model. And so we can imagine that, you know, there behaviorally there are things we can do to allow our own selves to presence, and to allow, create space for others to presence. But that's not been the American way. The American way has been to colonize and dominate through competition. It's all rigged now. There are people who are born into fabulous amounts of wealth. They have an unfair beginning. And they'll argue, they'll say, well, my ancestors worked hard and they built this and I deserve it. But the problem with that is that we have an unequal distribution of resources. It doesn't give everybody a fair voice. And we know that now in a democratic critique. You know, one person, one vote means absolutely nothing, because one person's vote could mean a million times more power than another, given their wealth, et cetera, et cetera. So then if you take that and apply that to individual relationships with others, you can see how that always leads to conflict, that there are basic assumptions of a relationship, what's called a dyad, an ontological structure, in other words, a logos. Logos just means a style or a reason or an understanding of being in that dyad. That's all it means. It's nothing, it's not that difficult. It's the how, it's the dynamic. And that's why when you go to marriage therapy or relational therapy or couples counseling, the therapist is going to try the best they can to uncover the dynamic. The dynamic gives you clues about the basic assumptions of that relationship, the ontological structure. In other words, what is allowed in? What is allowed in? And what is kept out? And so look at it now, take the same logic and apply it to interspecies relationship between humans and others. Humans and any kind of animal group or plant group or tree group of any kind. And you see what's happening is that humans have so dominated because of really, really stupid Christian ideas. See, and I'm going to pick on Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, they're all the same. Now, there are always exceptions, but by and large, these are philosophies of colonization and domination. I mean, look at the Catholic Church. Their history is one of absolute domination. You cannot presence unless it's within a Catholic understanding of the world. Same with these supposed gentler forms in Protestantism. There are many, but they're still colonized. And they still have that social dynamic. They still have a topology of the self we talk about, a certain structure of the self that is basic level to dominate. Now, there are some enlightened people on the planet right now who have grown out of that completely. There aren't very many of them. They're ahead of the game. There are people who are trying to transform out of that. But it's very difficult because the voracious, greedy dominators have a very easy time of it to destroy those who are more enlightened. This is the problem. And so this gives rise to powerful critiques of violence. Some brilliant theorists arguing that we need a period of counterviolence. It's a difficult dialogue, but for the sake of today, let's just talk about the dynamic. This is the dynamic. Competition. There are people who buy into this ideology hook, line, and sinker. And these are unthinking people. I don't care where they went to school, and I don't care how rich they are. They're not that intelligent because they're not wise. Competition can be good under highly structured circumstances. But as an overall overarching dynamic, it's a disaster. And it's a moral disaster because competition and capitalism together have displaced more important values. And they've so displaced other values that we talk about those other values, but they have no force and effect. And we go on and we produce more and more people who think capitalism and competition are intrinsically good things. And we produce people who go to Wharton and Stanford and Harvard, and they end up with MBAs, and they end up on Wall Street stealing money from everybody else. And they sit back and think about how smart they are. Well, they're not that smart. I'm happy to debate any one of them. So this is the situation we have. So critical phenomenology says this, and I want everybody to hear this. Because there's something underneath. There's something behind. Appearances. Behind or underneath appearances is the way we choose to structure the dynamic of appearance. That is our noetic, N-O-E-T-I-C, our noetic structure. We have a cultural noetic, like capitalism, competition. We have individual noetic structures. And they actually create the appearances of objects in the world. Now, once you wrap your head around this concept, you will be very happy. You will want to send Nazrita and me nice letters because it will empower you. There is not a universe. There's not a universe. There's something underneath of it, of what we take to be a naive, realistic notion of universe. There is a multiverse. There is mathematically, there's an infinite number of ontologies that create appearances. Now, to the creative people in our listenership, this should make you very happy, and you'll want to have another cup of coffee and a brownie, a piece of cake, because indeed, there's place for you in this world. There's a place for the poet. The poet is the most dangerous person alive. They're the most liberating. To be an artistic poet, to be a writing poet, but this is a person who creates the new. And they're dangerous because they go against the establishment. And the greatest poets of all force us into thinking about the pre-ontological, the Kora, C-H-O-R-A, the Kora, that comes from Plato's Timaeus, T-I-M-A-E-U-S. The Kora is the place from which being originates. It's the container of being. Now, this is a concept that's hard to understand. But for our purposes, if there are an infinite number of universes, that means we have a pluriverse or a multiverse. That means we have an infinite number of set structures. There's not just one. And for the creative thinker, this means that you can modify the set of all objects that have appeared. You can modify the set of all presencing objects. Now, this naturally changes the relationships amongst what we call existing objects, because all objects don't just sit in a sedentary way. They have relationships. And that complex set of relationships determines how each individual object can presence. That is why we do ecosystem design. This is the joy of ecosystem design. It is a challenge to every designer in the planet. It says, take your toolkit and think about what led to that toolkit, what led to your own mathematical thinking and your own analytical thinking, your own understandings of nonviolence and sourcing and supply chains and how people impact the environment, and how the design of their structures impact their relationships. This is all category theory. This is all ontology. And this is all critical phenomenology. So this is why the greatest designer architects like Palasma have backdoored their way, believe it or not, into phenomenology and into an understanding of ontology. They may not understand it right now. Maybe they do, but they have intuitively found their way into this understanding that mind creates reality. This is the beauty, and we are free. Even with the constrictions of our noetic structure, we have a capacity, a transcendental faculty, that can rethink the ontological structures that presence of the appearance of objects. What do you think about that, Nazarita?
I think that that is the basis of really everything that we're talking about. It's really exciting, actually, because I, for one, have not thought of it in exactly those terms. So I find it to be really stimulating. Like, if this were something that everyone could hear, I think it's life-changing in terms of what we do, especially there are so many opportunities that abound in what you're talking about. I find it really amazing, and I'd like you to say more about that. I want to reference something that you said earlier, which was you were going to talk about colonization and how this related, which I was thinking of these beautiful places, like people go to the mission in Monterey by Carmel by the Sea. And this mission is considered like a sacred place. Everybody goes there and sees these Chinese cells that monks used to live in that are very simple. And the mission is one of the highlights of people coming there. And yet, when I went there once on what is considered sacred ground, one of my friends said, this is a ground of tragedy. This is a ground of colonization and horrific slavery. And I suddenly saw this land very differently, that what happened was on the way of one hand, the church seeing it as sacred and converting all the Indians to a new faith, meanwhile enslaving them for a good cause. And on the other hand, this horrific tragedy of slavery and colonization taking away people's intrinsic value. And so it is really in the way that you see things, in the way that you're able to put things together, which is just what you're talking about. If you're seeing a forest and you only see board feet for lumber, you're not really seeing the forest. You're seeing an interpretation of the forest, and that applies to every being. If you see a being as someone that just you can mold to your desires, you're not really seeing that being, like what we've talked about so often. So if you would say more, I find this to be really so helpful.
Well, I'll add one concept. And then we'll close for today. But let's talk about it a little bit. This comes from Michel Foucault. And early in his career, he moved, not completely, but he moved from phenomenology and hermeneutics to his own critical method in mental illness and psychology, and then also in madness and civilization, and later something he called the forms of experience. And so he became really interested in the forms of experience in a culture, like it was a finite number. You could take a snapshot of a culture, and there would be a finite number of forms of experience. What that meant was there was only so many ways in that culture that were legitimate to experience being and how being appeared. That's that fascist, totalitarian, social political movement that all the critical theorists talk about. So you can have forms of experience in a household. In other words, you're a part of a family. Only certain forms of experience are legitimated. A simple example is a person who grew up homosexual, but that wasn't allowed in their family. So that means that person's form of experience was not in the home. There was it could not appear. It was excluded. So that was below the line in our Cartesian model. So, but it was still there. And so the quest for critical phenomenology is to take a look at what forms of experience allow appearance. And to me, that's one way. It's not the only way of talking about this or articulating it. But if I were to talk to a really smart designer, I would talk to them about it. Forms of experience. What's allowed in this house? What's allowed in this landscape where this person just built a 10,000 square foot house? You know, what did they destroy? What forms of experience did they suppress? What parts of the ecosystem will no longer presence in that area because of their oppression? Even violence, violent design suppresses forms of experience. Think about government design, government buildings. Think about tract housing, apartments. So this is a fertile area for lots of different sorts of thinkers and practitioners to demarginalize certain forms of experience. So we're out of time. Let's thank everybody. Here we are at almost the end of August. And as you go through your week, we invite everybody to think about what's excluded in your home, what's not allowed, what's not allowed in your marriage, what's not allowed in your kids' experience, what's not allowed in the home, what's not allowed at work, and how these exclusions or preclusions affect what appears. And think about now how we're taking that same way of thinking into the natural world and suppressing forms of experience. All other sentient beings, forms of experience of rivers, forms of experience of forest lands. And we'll be right back at you next week. We'll continue on our discussion. This is Epis Radio, wishing you all a great week, and we'll be back in a week. Thank you.